G'day, I'm Osher Ginsburg.
And I'm Charlie Clawson.
We are two dads who, when we found out we were going to be dads, went looking for a podcast that could help us navigate what it means to be a dad in the modern world.
I mean, there were parenting podcasts, but they all seemed to be aimed at mums, or at the very least, mums and dads.
Yeah, there were no podcasts for dads specifically, and certainly not dads who want to be hands-on and do their share of raising their children.
So, we started Dad Pod, a podcast by dads, for dads who don't want to be shit dads.
Each week we share our own stories from the good and the bad to the thermonuclear tantrums, as well as talk with some of the biggest experts in the field to help all of us become better dads.
So if you're a dad, a mum dad, or a dad-to-be, search Dad Pod where you get your podcasts.
The following episode of FOFOP is rated MA. It contains alternating hosts, a rotating roster of guests, and mild coarse language. FOFOP advises that it is not suitable for anyone under the age of 15 or anyone who came here looking for one of those highbrow NPR-type podcasts. Minors must be accompanied by a parent or guardian. This is John Deek speaking.
Hello and welcome to FOFOP. I'm Charlie Clawson, and my guest this week is FOFOP alum now. I think I can say that after more than three appearances. Adam Zwar, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. I like being an alum.
An alum. Is it alumni or alum? What are they? Does it mean the same thing?
I looked it up once. So you're alumni if you're, you know, if you're, you know, like you are a Xavier alum, or you could be alumnus. Mm. I don't know what's the plural. So plural would obviously be alumni.
From the Latin alum, meaning a member of. I don't know. I'm making that up.
I guess so. I didn't. I got to school in grade 9, and we did grade 8 was when we did. When I went to my posh school, yeah. I got there in year 9, so I missed out on doing Latin, which was year 8.
When it came to choosing languages at my school, you could choose, I think it was French or Italian or Latin. And I chose Latin with this high-minded idea that, well, because it's really the history of the English language, it'll give me greater insight into English.
Latin and Greek.
What a terrible decision that was. I mean, the Catholic Church wasn't even doing Latin masses at that point. Like, there was no, it was purely an academic pursuit. There was no practical application for learning Latin. And then I was never, I think my last Latin exam was in year 10 or maybe year 11. And I think I scored 7 out of 40, however it was marked. And I remember the teacher just wrote a note saying, "You're not even trying." Which was very.
Mate, you're lucky to get, I mean, 7's fine. You know, I do kind of envy those people.
7 out of 40. Yeah, sorry.
Well, look, I envy people who have got a bit of Latin. I just kind of, it just elevates them in the conversation. And also, you know, I would love to, I just don't have the bandwidth to be a snob about anything, you know. But I do admire snobs. I go, good on you. You know, you have to do a bit of work to be a snob.
Yeah.
What, about anything. You need to really hit the books.
Well, I think our year 10 Latin teacher, Mr. Hartley, I believe his name was, and he was that classic, real dry, academic kind of teacher, like the elbow patches and everything, but never showed any kind of flash of personality or humor or anything. And he was very, very rigid in terms of how, you know, you learnt all the kind of, you know, the OST, Mus Tisnente, and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, I remember we had this one class where he just had us translating these phrases, these Latin phrases that we'd never seen before. Like, he wrote up like 3 different or 4 different phrases, and they were quite complex, and we're sort of breaking them down by part and the derivations and everything. And then by the end of the class, what we realized is we're breaking down dirty limericks in Latin. Like, there was one, and I can't remember if this is the exact.
Mr. Hartley.
Yeah, Mr. Hartley, but it was something like Luscus Induperator, which is, this is my one-eyed general.
Oh, fantastic. He was obviously having a good day.
Yeah.
I did have a German teacher called Dr. Melson, who was very stylish. He used to wear leather flares.
Really? To a private school?
He wasn't being stylish. I went to school in late 80s, so he would have been, he thought that cool fashion was whatever was in Germany in the 70s when he left it.
Right. Okay.
And
so, like the Berlin years for David Bowie and Nick Cave. He was like, that's
Well, that's that. It's the Seinfeld thing where you can tell the greatest year in a man's life. It's the clothes he's wearing.
Yeah.
So Miss Dr. Melson, beautiful head of hair, very stylish. Everything had. He could scull like a liter of beer without like spilling a drop, because he'd take us to the Munich Steakhouse in Brisbane for excursions where he'd like get into sculling competitions. Fantastic. Had a scar down his neck. So I don't know what, like it was obviously a war wound of some sort. Anyway, a friend of mine, like a few years after I left, a friend of mine ran into him in the street and he said, where are you? He asked Dr. Melson asked my friend where he was studying. My friend said, USQ. And he said, who else is there from school? And my friend said, Adam Zwa. And Dr. Melson said, Zwa? University? Bullshit. I hope he's still alive. He was great.
Yeah, there was one teacher. We had one King of the Kids. Well, we had a couple of King of the Kids. One of our headmasters, who was a priest, was a King of the Kids. And his sort of default was always dirty jokes. Like, you know, he'd always order, you know, ask you what hand you wanked with and all this kind of stuff. Like really
full on. Oh, my God. Yeah.
But he ended up leaving, like scandalously leaving the priesthood and marrying a married woman. Like he sort of went from 0 to 100 in terms of like Catholicism. Like
not what, only- hang on. So this is it. He was at Xavier.
Yeah.
And then he left. He was a priest, and then he left.
He was a priest. He was a headmaster, and he left and married, and ran off with a woman who was married.
That would have been the front page of The Age.
Yeah, I mean, I can't remember if my memory is so vague. I can't remember if this is still while I was at school or if it happened after I was at school. But there was another teacher, and I can't remember his name either. Probably won't bring up his surname even if I did, because he. But he was like the real king of the kids, like the guy that all the students loved. You know, he was like one of the boys. You could hang out. You could talk to him about anything. He was a confidant. He ran the ski trips. Like when we did the ski trips, he was the guy who organized it, and he was just a fun guy. And then it turned out he had embezzled like tens of thousands of dollars from the school. Like these, I think these ski trips were a front for him just like skimming like a whole heap of money. And so it's just like, oh, wow.
No wonder it was happening. I'm just looking through your notable alumni.
Yeah.
So Tim Fisher, former deputy PM.
Oh, there's a lot.
PM.
Yeah. I think part of the D generation. I think Santo and Tom Gleiser.
Oh, Santo went there. Okay. I'm just looking through it. Obviously, Bill Shorten.
Former opposition leader Tim Smith, I believe.
Oh, my God. Was Tim Smith there?
Oh, no. He was Scotch, I think.
Josh Kennedy, current Swans co-captain.
Yeah. A lot of AFL footballers.
Oh, Luke Ball.
Yep.
Luke Ball.
Right. Yeah. Tim Watt.
Collingwood St. Kilda.
Joe Watson,
isn't it?
Yeah, David Burke, former Tiger. There's a lot. I mean, you could literally, it's Assumption and Xavier are AFL footy factories. In fact, I think my year level, like when I got to high school, Xavier had won like 11 of the last 13 APS, you know, AFL premierships, which they tabulate by most wins in a season. And then my year level came along and we were the first year level to only win like 3 games for the year or something like that.
We were just a bad year for football.
A lot of entertainers, comedians, Lawrence Lung, Michael Chamberlain came out of that.
Oh, really?
I came out of that year, but yeah, not a lot of
But here's a funny factoid. So Les Patterson, the fictional character portrayed by Barry Humphries, attended Xavier College.
Yeah, well, that would make sense.
Because obviously Barry used to make fun of Catholics.
Yeah. Well, reading your book 12 Summers, which we talked about last time you're on the show, I actually found a lot of the stories you boarded at your high school.
Yeah, yeah. So Brisbane Grammar, which is I'm just looking up now, famous for Malcolm Farr, Canberra-based political journalist, Michael Ware, CNN journalist, David Malouf, the novelist, obviously Powderfinger.
They all go between.
a few hurdy gurus.
Really?
And then, you know, a lot
so
of
the Wallabies. Are a Queensland band. I always thought they were Sydney.
Well, one of them was, I think it was Brad Shepherd went there.
Okay, right. Because I think Dave Faulkner's a pretty, like, tried and true Sydney. So I used to see his XB Falcon or his Ford Cobra in Bondi all the time. Like his white Cobra with the racing stripes.
Yeah, Robert Forster, Go-Betweens.
Oh, yeah.
I'm just, and then like a whole bunch of Wallabies, and then a bunch of, God, the Wallabies. There's like, you know, just heaps of Wallabies, and then there's a few cricketers.
Yeah, we're reading your memoirs and your experience of boarding school just brought back, because there was boarders at my school as well, and and this the story that the wank police let people know who were the wank police.
Okay, so that was a cool, I mean, you have to understand, late 80s Brisbane, Fitzgerald Inquiry, it was chaos. You went to this expensive school, so the day school were all like super cool kind of kids, very academic, you know, in lunch hours, they would be arguing about the, you know, Joy Division versus New Order. It was just that, you know, they were all kind of very urbane. And then you had these, so that was the 1,300 people were day students. And then you had 200 people who were boarders, and they were all from the country. And they were just like, they didn't need to pass the academic requirements to get in. And so essentially that the IQ dropped 10, 15 points as soon as you walked into the boarding house. And it was chaos, and each dorm had a kind of a little housemaster who were rugby guys. Like, we had Greg Martin, who played for the Wallabies, and they just didn't give a shit about any discipline or anything. So essentially, it was Lord of the Flies. It was the kids looking after, you know, disciplining fellow kids, and the biggest faction in the boarding house, as far as kind of power, the biggest power faction were the wanking police. And that was like five or six guys, all pretty cool, running around in Sunny Boys t-shirts. And they're all from Noosa.
Were a self-appointed
group.
I mean, ironically, vigilante group, but with a moniker of police.
And so you'd be on the toilet, and then suddenly this would happen periodically, a face would jump over the divider and look over you and just see if you're wanking. and if you were wanking, that was the end of your career at that school. Mm. It would just go, the news flash, it would go straight from the toilets into the boarding house proper, to the house masters, to the day school. And it was pretty much you were gone. And I, you know, it never happened to me, but it happened to a bunch of guys who I was friends with. And it was just horrible for them. It was horrible because it was literally bullying for the next 3 to 5 years. So what would happen, it would be like, you know, someone get caught and be like, Joe Bloggs, busted, wanking.
Yeah.
And then he's like, we'd go out into the day school and it was just horrible.
Was it like the Spanish Inquisition? Do you think some of these were just like, whether or not the kid had been caught, they were just made up? Because I know there was kids at my school, like there was guys who came into the school with nicknames from the junior school. And you're like, like there's one guy whose nickname was Hoover. And the rumor was that his brother had caught him putting his dick in the vacuum cleaner. And everyone just accepted that was the truth. And like, it had gone beyond bullying to the point where it was just an accepted fact. He was just Hoover. And even Hoover, I mean, this is awful. I'm trying to think what his real name was, and I can't remember.
Hoover. Yeah, that's a big thing too. You need to remember their actual names when you go out into the community or post-school, because all the guys I know who were busted wanking had wanking related names. What would happen, it was like there was one guy, and Wilfred fans will know this. He was called Tugger Doug. And so you get 200 boys for assembly on Friday and Saturday nights, and the housemaster would come in and say a few words, and then we'd watch a video. It was before the days we had screens, and it was like, you know, you had one TV, just, you know, 200 guys sitting around it. And, you know, watch a movie that the prefect had chosen. Anyway, so we'd all have to walk into the assembly, and so then Tiger Doug would walk in, and 200 boys would be going, Tiger Doug, Tiger Doug, Tiger Doug, Tiger Doug, Tiger Doug. And it was just like, it was just, you know, it was like kind of a menacing.
Yeah,
it's the worst part of masculinity. It was this menacing chant. And I always wondered what happened to that guy. And then, just per your question, all the guys I know who got busted did admit to it.
Right.
But
was that under duress? Was that like, you know,
they just went, like,
something like that, where it's like under intense kind of interrogation? You admit to it just to end it?
Look, they were generally new kids.
Okay.
And they didn't know that we had such a kind of puritanical thing about wanking, not to wank. And so they go, what the fuck is going on?
Yeah, like, of course. Everyone because from wanks. Their point of view, it's like everyone does it. What am, yeah. You know, what am I being hounded for?
What did I walk into? It's like walking into the South, like Alabama or somewhere, yeah. You know, and doing something slightly kind of sexual.
Yeah.
Like being gay, maybe, in Alabama.
I mean, boys' schools are weird environments, aren't they? Like, you know, there's that side of it. There's the weird kind of like suppressed sexuality thing, but there's also the, I mean, especially in the 80s when you and I were younger. But, you know, I remember going to a friend of mine, his mother had passed away, and it was only a couple of years after my father had passed away. And I would have been like 13 at the time. And I remember sort of being at the funeral with a bunch of guys from school, because we're obviously all friends with this kid whose mother had passed away. And, you know, just during the service, I got really upset because it obviously reminded me of the time my father died, and I started crying. And I remember my friends were like appalled and kind of getting angry at me for crying, like, stop crying. Oh, wow. Like, what are you doing? Like, it's not about you. And it's like, yeah, I know. Like, this is not, I'm not trying to take attention away. And I even remember, like, even a year after my dad died, this football team I played for, we all went out for a pizza night before the season started, you know, and I think we had pizza and went to Luna Park. And it was a similar thing where I got a bit overwhelmed and started crying and went to, like, you know, go to the bathroom to cry. And one of the coaches coming in and berating me for, like, ruining the night. Like, just, you know, just making everyone uncomfortable, stop crying. And it's just like, holy shit. Like, I really hope that all boys' schools have changed since then. And that, like,
oh, they have. They really have. But that is horrible, mate. And also, you would have been known, because not many kids would have experienced tragedy in the sense of a parent dying at such a young age. And so you would have been known as the kid whose dad had died.
Yeah.
You know,
so it makes you a bit weird. I mean, you become an other automatically.
Yeah, that's right. And it's like, because they don't know how to actually process that kind of grief. And, you know, because they never experienced it. And some people, you know, get to their 40s and never experience a parent dying or anyone close to them dying, you know? It's, at school, that, you know, I mean, it's absolutely appalling that teachers or coaches or, you know, people in authority didn't have any access to how to help a kid deal with that situation. Yeah. It really is. But I totally relate to it.
Well, I also remember being funneled into like a year. So the year after my dad died, they had this, I guess it was like a Christian counselor, like, you know, a sort of religious based counselor. And it wasn't optional. Like, me and another kid whose parents were divorced and another kid who had maybe lost a parent as well, like, the weird, you know, the kids who'd experienced some kind of trauma were funneled into this involuntary counseling that we had to do, like, one lunch every week or something. And it was just this woman who was so ill-equipped. Like, she was approaching it less from a psychological point of view and more from a religious point of view about, like, you know, well, your dad's in heaven and everything is good and, you know, he's proud of you and all this kind of stuff. And it was just, I just remember it was confusing more than anything. And the kid whose parents was divorced, he felt like, well, what am I doing here? Like, my parents are still alive. Like, my mum and dad are both still alive. Like, I feel like this is kind of awkward for me to sit here and listen to these other kids talk about their, like, dead siblings and parents, and all my parents, they just don't get along. I mean, it was the best intentions. They wanted, they thought, oh, this is good. We can help these kids who are going through a tough time. But it's like one size fits all. Divorce, you know, that's a stretch of death.
I do love it. Just bear in mind, you know, the boarding house, I mean, Xavier was so far advanced, more advanced than my school, because Skippy Lynch was the counselor, and he was a pedophile.
Oh yeah,
and
he had a few of those too.
Yeah, and then, but the other thing was that the boarding house that. So one of the kids in the boarding house killed both his parents.
Oh shit!
And he went to jail. And then there was another guy who went to jail.
He was a teenager, when as an adult.
Yeah.
What?
I don't know exactly. I'll just look it up. I'm not going to say his name.
No.
But it was. It might have happened very. If it didn't happen straight after school, during school, it happened soon after.
Oh my god!
And but he went to obviously went to jail for life. So he would have been he would have been late. 19 he was. So yeah, he'd left school. So he murdered his parents. And then there was another guy who went to jail soon after leaving school. For manslaughter, and then there was another guy. This is all in my kind of era, and then there was another guy who was the syringe bandit. So remember in the early 90s when AIDS was such a scary thing, and so people would walk into 7-Elevens with syringes full of blood and go, "This is AIDS, hand over the money."
Happened to me.
And oh, really?
When I was working in a video store in Sandringham, this couple came into the store, this guy and this girl. It was back in the days of VHS, we'd keep the tapes out the back. And one of them had brought up, like, you know, the cover of the video they wanted. I'd gone out the back to get the tape. And when I came back out, they were both behind the counter trying to open the till. And I was a bit sort of like flabbergasted. And I said, "What are you doing?" And the guy pulled out like a bloody syringe and was like, "You know, this is HIV or whatever, like, open the till." And I don't know what was going through my mind, but I was not intimidated. Like, I found the whole thing a bit kind of bizarre and weird. And he wasn't overly aggressive or threatening. Like, he wasn't much bigger than me. He wasn't yelling. You know, he seemed kind of scared and nervous. And she seemed a bit, you know, they're junkies. And she seemed a bit like flighty as well. And so I just refused. I said no. And then he sort of didn't know what to do. And he was kind of like brandishing the needle. And in my head, I'm like, well, I think I could sort of step back. I think there's a broomstick here. I feel like I could swat him away. So I just said, "No, I'm not going to open the till." I said, "But look, I'm going to call the cops, but I'll give you a minute to get out of the store before I do it." And then his girlfriend was like, "Come on, let's go. And so I just remember the last thing he said, he sort of stared at me for a moment with this like bloody needle. Then he just said, "Oh, I'm sorry." And then he just bolted. And I let them go. And for a second, I contemplated not calling the police because I'm like, "Oh God, this is sad. Like, who knows what situation has led to them doing this." But then I was like, fuck it. That guy like was threatening me with a bloody syringe. So I did call the police. And
Holy shit.
They had done
it. What a cool cucumber you are. Jesus.
It was weird, man. Like, I don't think I am a cool cucumber in normal circumstances. It was this specific set of circumstances. I just did not feel like if I had walked out and he'd smacked me over the head or had started yelling or, you know, made himself big or whatever, like, you know, I have no interest in getting into a physical confrontation with anyone.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But what was the movie they were after? What movie did you go back?
I don't remember, but I do remember, like, this is, it's so, but I thought she was quite cute. And I remember when she was like, walking around the store, I sort of was like, "Oh man, she's cute. Like, I wonder if they're a couple, you know, blah, blah, blah." And then that was enough to kind of distract me. I mean, she wasn't flirting with me or anything like that. I was just sort of looking at her. But apparently they had done they were on a run of stores from Frankston. They had been hitting like servos and retail shops all the way up. And I remember the cops came, and because Sandringham, you know, upper middle class suburb, they don't get a lot of that kind of action. And so the cops are just so excited to like tape up the store and zoom around in their cars. And I do also remember the detectives like showing me, they had some mug shots to show me, and then being quite insistent that I finger certain ethnic groups, like they were directing me towards certain perps that they obviously had an issue with or were really hoping that they could pin it on. And I was like, no, it wasn't.
No, it's the cop stuff in those days, mate. Hang on, I'm just getting my jacket. You know, I wrote about that in the book too, which my first ever girlfriend, she broke up with me and I was devastated. And then about 4 weeks later, she got a car stolen and the cops went around to her place and said, any idea who might have done this? You know, so often it's someone who's close to you. And she said, no, everything's fine. Although I did break up with my boyfriend a few weeks ago and he's pretty upset. Oh, really? Really, madam? And so I'm sitting in the dining hall
the cops circling your house at the moment, sounds like.
Can hear it. I'm sitting in this dining hall of 200 people. And, you know, it was like, you know, we're all undergraduates at university and on campus. And so when two guys walk in with wearing Roger David's suits, you know, they're not students, they're cops. And so I was taken downtown, given a good questioning. And then fortunately, you know, I wasn't beaten up or anything, but it was yelled at. There was a good cop, bad cop, a lot of threatening behavior. And then they end up finding the dude.
Yeah, right.
It wasn't me. Obviously, it wasn't me. And I wouldn't even give me a cab charge home.
That's fantastic. I remember a cop hitting on my ex-girlfriend. Like, she had her car broken into. You know, she's a very pretty girl, like an actress. And I remember the cop was, you know, in all honesty, he was quite good looking himself. They would have made a great couple. he looked like he could have been on, he looked like a TV cop. He was good looking, had a tan, muscular. But I remember, like, you know, we were down by the car, broken window, he'd pulled up and he was just, you know, taking notes. But he was just out and out flirting with her. I can't remember the exact thing. He's like, now, wow. I'm going to have to get your number. I promise I'll only call you for professional reasons. And she's like, oh, you? And I'm like, hey, I'm standing right here.
Jesus. Now they've got three kids.
Yeah, no, exactly.
That's fucking hell. It would have been a good time to be a cop. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, yeah. I knew a cop in the late 90s. He was a friend of a friend. And like, this dude was the most amoral, untrustworthy. Like, this guy would, you know, he would sell drugs that they had stolen from like raids. He would have sex with people while on duty, you know, like people that they'd picked up. He was just, it was that classic bad lieutenant kind of cliche.
Yeah, yeah.
Just like he just wanted a license to behave with complete impunity. And then like, you'd think that at some point he would get his just dessert, some kind of like internal affairs or whatever, but he hurt his back in some operation, like as in police operation. And then just got a huge compo payout. So the taxpayer, this guy, like, basically rode roughshod over the system for 5 or 6 years and then retired in his early 30s because of he got, like, a compo payout.
Sometimes you're just lucky. Like, I mean, a couple of things. I would say when my scout master went to jail on sexual abuse charges, I was called to give evidence and I remember the child protection unit just being the best bunch of people, just like, you know, caring, really determined to get the evidence required, you know, required, not an underhand way at all, but in a very thorough way. And so I remember thinking, oh, that's really great that, you know, that kind of police work is done. But then when I did Top of the Lake, I played a cop, a detective, and Christian Van Vuren and I we spent some time with the detectives. I think it was Bondi.
Mm.
And my God, they dress well now. like they are like, you know, that whole kind of like, you know, the cliche of the Roger David suit, which I talked about before, is completely gone. They're generally only cops until they're about 35 and then they go off and make a huge amount of money in the corporate sector doing corporate security and everything now. So you very rarely get anyone in the – well, they were telling me you very rarely get anyone over 40 working in the – being a detective.
Well, also too, like when I was doing my police training before Blue Heelers, I did like 2 weeks of police training and did like a week of ride-alongs. And what I determined is if you meet a constable or even a senior constable in their 40s, they're a dead shit. Because they are like anyone with any kind of common sense or actual commitment to the job who wants to actually do good, they rise up the ranks fairly quickly. But the guys who just like putting on a uniform and being bullies, like they tend to stay at that level. So if you're a young cop, you know, it's only 3 months of training or whatever before they're out of the academy. And then, you know, you can rise pretty quick if you've got any aptitude for it. But if you've if you've been in that job for 10 years and you've only risen as far like one rank, because these two guys that I had to do the ride along with out in Preston, I think it was. And I remember like the first day they were so like, ugh, this fucking got to babysit this little, you know, spoiled brat actor. And so they didn't want to talk to me for the first like hour or two. And then when I started asking questions, they were like, oh, cool. Like we get to, you know, talk up, you know, what we do.
Big note ourselves.
Yeah. And then they were like, oh, we've got to get you some action, man. Like we've got to get you, you know, hopefully there's a stabbing or something like that. And I'm like, no, I don't want to. Keep me well away. you can just tell me about it. I'm good at it. I've got a good imagination. I can absorb it. But I remember we went to some boarding house where a lot of criminals, when they get released, it's the only place they can afford.
Oh, yeah. Halfway house.
Yeah. So they went there and they said, just you're a plainclothes detective if they ask you who you are. I'm like, okay. So we walked in and they just did some kind of like check on who's staying here with the woman who ran the boarding house. And then she sort of looked at me and she was like, you undercover? And I'm like, yes. Like in a sense, I guess I'm undercover. Like I'm an undercover actor, not an undercover cop. and then it got to the end of the day and they were really bummed out because there'd been no call outs or anything. And then they finally got a call and it was the Department of Health Services were calling because there's a man with dementia, an elderly, I think he was like Scandinavian, so it's Norwegian or something like that. And he'd been on his front lawn waving around a knife and the neighbors were worried that he was going to hurt himself. And so the DHS had turned up, but he'd locked himself in the house. And so now they were calling the police to come lend some assistance. And so these guys, they hit the lights. You know, we blew through a couple of intersections. We got to this like suburban house and, you know, the ambulance there, the DHS, and they're like, oh, look, he's locked himself inside. He's ranting about his stolen money. So, you know, clearly he's in the grips of some kind of psychosis or dementia. And so we go up to the front door and the two constables are like talking to the guy through his locked flywire. And the guy's like, you know, ranting and raving about, you know, my money. And he's got this little, I guess it's like a carving knife. That was the knife that the neighbors are seeing him waving around. It wasn't like a butcher's knife or anything. It's like a little, you know, like a whittling knife.
Oh, yeah.
And so he's got that in his hand and the cops are like, mate, you know, can you just put the knife down and just come up? We just want to talk to you. And the guy was like, no, they've taken my money. And so one of the cops says to him, hey, look, we just need proof that this is your house. So can you just go get your title deed and bring it back and then we can keep talking. And so the old guy went off. And while he's doing that, the cops pulled out their like pocket knife and cut through the flywire and unlocked his door. And then when this old man came back, and when I say old, he was like in his 80s, like brittle. He came back, they yanked the door open. They gang tackled him to the ground, like smashed him into the ground, like put his arms behind his back. Like the DHS and the ambulance were like, no, it's fine. Like we just need to get him into the ambulance. But they were.
Oh, my God.
And so they got him into the ambulance. And then afterwards, the ride back to the station, these two dudes were so pumped up. Like that the adrenaline was running. They wanted to go for a drink afterwards. And I'm just like, this is fucked up.
Oh, my God. And had you done any acting on Blue Heelers up until that moment, or was this part of your prep?
That was part of my prep. No. But then I went in and did some actual work at the academy with the detectives, and that was actually very helpful. And they were great. It was just these two guys that I remember thinking.
Two guys. It's like, right, I worked on No Activity in the US, and we did an episode where Jessica Alba is doing a ride along. And
as herself, as Jessica Alba?
I think she was insert famous actress.
Right.
I don't know. She was herself, actually. I can't remember now. We were after Margot Robbie for a long time, and we thought we had her on the hook, but no. Jessica Alba's fine.
Isn't she a billionaire now or something? She come up with some kind of she runs some baby business empire or something like that.
Wow, well, you're the dude. You're asking me. You're Mr. Zeitgeist. You're Dr. Zeitgeist. What
My
era
point
were
being
you?
Is why did she do No Activity?
Nah, that's right. I think she thought it was funny, but if that, you know, those, you know, Patty Bramble in.
Do you know what? Do you know what she's worth? She runs a company that is valued at $2 billion, and she has a personal net worth of almost $400 million. So it's amazing you got her. Like, I mean, I know you wanted Margot Robbie, but it's actually more impressive that you got the person who runs the billion-dollar company.
That's unbelievable. And here I was really excited. I was like, yeah, Jessica Alba. When Bob Odenkirk came on board, ooh, that was a special moment for me.
Yeah, he's awesome.
And I was just helping out with the writing, but there was Will Ferrell was on.
Yeah,
that was interesting.
Yeah, they got a great cast for No Activity, the American version. I mean, the Australian cast was also excellent, but like the names that you got, considering how low budget the show was, like
Clements.
Yeah, that was just a testament to obviously the concept, and you know.
Yeah, Trent and Patty, Trent O'Donnell and Patrick Bramwell, the creators of it, and you know, it's can I just, you know, reiterate? I was just a hanger on. Please don't think I'm taking any credit for this.
No, Adam Zwar's No Activity, I believe. That's how it's called. On CBS in direct, what it's called.
Yeah, I wrote the episode. I mean, I was in the room, but I wrote the episode called The Crow, if anyone's interested.
Right.
It was Will Ferrell, I think, said one of my lines. So, you know. Rock and roll. But yeah, what era were you on Blue Heelers? Who was the cast?
Like the mid-2000s. So I think I started at the end of 2003 and wrote it to the end.
It was Ditch Davis still there?
Yeah, Ditch, yeah. We were partners. We were, our characters were Ditch as in Hole.
Yeah, so forgive me for I wasn't still watching.
Our backstory was we were childhood mates, and now we're cops.
So. Well, I mean, I did my two tours of duty on Blue Heelers.
There's two different characters.
Yeah. But they had two different names, Charlie. Okay. They're pretty much the same character.
criminal or good guy?
Oh, crooks. Yeah. It was Arnie Violet and I can't remember the other one. The first one was Will McInnes had to throw me up against a caravan. It was a tent boxing episode.
Yeah.
And Will McInnes throws me up against a caravan, and the director says to him, Will, you need to pad Adam down now. And he goes, how do I do that? And the director goes, you just pad him down. And Will goes, oh, I'm sorry. I'm an actor playing a cop, all right? I'm not actually a cop. And I remember thinking, oh, my God, tension. And Will was just being, you know, difficult.
Yeah.
And that same time, Damien Walsh Howling said to Lisa McCune, we're just about to do a scene, and he said to Lisa McCune, Lisa, you've got a little bit of a lazy eye.
for action.
What the fuck are you doing, Damien? Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. You just got a little bit of a. You tried to make it sound cute. You got a little bit of a lazy eye. And I accidentally kicked Tasma Walton while I was being arrested. That was a low point. Sorry, yeah. Tasman. Is it Tasma? Tasman?
Tasma.
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 So yeah. That was the glory days with Lisa and Tasma. I mean, they were a fucking rock star.
Well, it's funny too, that show, the way it morphed from your kind of meat and potatoes Aussie country drama. And then round about two, I think just before I joined actually, they went that NYPD blue, you know, desaturated, cinema verite, handheld camera, crash zooms in the interview, in the interrogation room.
Well, that didn't happen in my day. No.
No, you would have been there for the country practice sort of style of shooting, whereas I came in for the gritty, the realism.
Wow.
Which is
kind of funny. Come up?
Yeah, they did. When I joined, it was doing really well. I think we actually, I mean, it sounds insane. We were axed when we were rating like 1.2 million. Like nowadays, like that would just be, that'd be selling that concept.
That was stupid even then. 1.2 million. I mean, anything over 1 million is a win.
I think the they had to lose a drama because they're trying to get the footy rights back from 10. And so they were trying to pull their money. And so it was a question between All Saints and Blue Heelers. And I think All Saints was an in-house production. They owned it outright. And Blue Heelers was Southern Star or one of those.
I mean, they could have just limited the amount of episodes. I mean, how many episodes did you shoot a year?
It was insane, like 40 or something like that. Like a
site. It's insane. And by the way, the best crew ever.
Yes.
It was like, you know, I've done a lot of – it was just so welcoming to guesties. And we've discussed this on this podcast before. I mean, being a guestie is like being a kid on the first day of school. Yeah. It's a horrible experience. No one wants to talk to you. And Blue Heelers were always really friendly.
Yeah.
You know?
All those long-running dramas, I find that's the case because
Stingers wasn't. Stingers wasn't.
No. Actually, McLeod's wasn't either.
And Sea Change wasn't either. But I remember once on Stingers, and by the way, love Peter Phelps. But Phelps, he came in, and this is like he just done Baywatch, so he was top of the pops.
Yeah.
And he came in to the dressing room, and it was obvious that someone had read his age, had read his paper.
Right.
And then there was a big kind of inquisition as to who might have read his paper. There's no ending to that story because I don't know who ended up reading, but he goes, who the fuck read my age?
That was always the rule on – I only did like 3 months on Neighbours, but I remember in the green room, because the green room was like a big shared, you know, communal green room, that I sat down in who played Lou on Neighbours? What was that actor's name?
Yeah.
Well, I sat down in his chair, and apparently, like, that was a huge no-no. It just looked like a chair. It wasn't like marked or anything. It was just a chair at a table.
I sat down in Lou's chair.
And someone said, oh, you can't sit there. That's Lou's chair. And I'm like,
Oh, my God. Man, Luke Carpenter was played by Tom Oliver. Oh, yeah.
Tom Oliver. Yeah. It was Tom Oliver's chair.
He had a very deep voice, Tom Oliver, I remember. Wow.
I remember meeting Phelpsy at a Logies 1 year, and I completely endeared myself to him because I'd read his memoir,
Sex Without Madonna.
And I don't know even how I came across it. I just remember seeing it in the library and being like, oh, you know, they think back in those days, like Australian actors writing memoirs about times in Hollywood were pretty rare. And so I read it and I quite enjoyed it. And I saw him at the Logies and I said, hey, man, like, and he was so chuffed that someone had read his book. He just wanted to sit down and have a chat about it.
Yeah. I remember at the height of his, you know, when I just mentioned before, the height of his kind of Baywatch Stingers fame, he was at Sunset Strip in St Kilda. Do you remember that? Gray Street?
Uh-huh.
And
near the intersection.
Yeah. And he was at the bar, two blondes either side, dark sunglasses, and he was kind of people coming up to him and he's like giving them nothing. And then my mate went up to him and said, I read your book and I loved it, Phelpsy. And sunglasses came off, untangled himself from the girls. Really? Really? You liked it?
That's funny too, man. Like when Will used to have an apartment in West Hollywood. Oh, you've been to that apartment. You came around.
Oh, yeah.
We did some pods there. And did you know that Dolph Lundgren lived in that same building?
Yes, I did. Yeah, I did.
I don't know if we talked about it, but it became a running joke on TOEFOP when I was staying there and Will was back here. I was like, I keep running into Dolph at the gym, and I want to talk to him, but I don't know what the in should be, because everyone's going to come up and be like Rocky IV or, you know, whatever.
Drago.
You know, Ivan Drago, you know.
Yeah.
And so I watched one of you. He did a TED talk about mental health, because he'd been through some kind of mental health breakdown. He, you know, had a fairly rough childhood growing up in Sweden. And so I was in the gym, and he came in as he normally did, and, you know, we normally would just nod at each other and not talk. And then as he was finishing up, I was finishing up, I said, "G'day, Dolph." I said, "My name's Charlie. We actually, you know, we're neighbors." I said, "Man, I just happened to see your TED talk, and I just thought it was fantastic." And hey, same thing. Just was so rapt that someone wanted to talk about something other than playing Ivan Drago. He was like, "Oh yeah, that was really, you know, I worked really, I was very nervous about that, you know, but I'm so glad. Where did you see it?" And so you're Australian. I spent quite a bit of time in Australia. In fact, I worked on the, and I said, "I know."
Oh yeah, yeah.
You worked on the door.
My name, Derek, who worked with him.
Yeah, and that's where you met Grace Jones, I believe. And wow. Now all of a sudden, like, well, now you know too much information.
You're such a journo, mate. I mean, I think you're probably a natural journo. I mean, to kind of always work the angles like that, because that's what journos need to do. Is like, you got to go, okay, I'm interviewing this person who's being interviewed 1,000 times. What's my angle? What's something different? And, you know, you're doing that naturally. So I guess it's kind of inevitable that you're doing podcasts. But, yeah, I live next door to Chris O'Dowd, but I didn't have a
an in.
I didn't have an in. I mean, I had several ins, but I just didn't want to because we lived next door to each other. It wasn't like we were in the same apartment. He walked past me so many times a week.
Mm.
I just didn't want to kind of go for him to make him feel uncomfortable and go, "Oh, there's that Australian fan." Again,
you wanted to enter the conversation as on par, like as equals.
So we could just be like neighbors, as opposed to me going, "Oh, I really, really liked what you did in, you know, in Get Shorty," or you know, IT Crowd.
It is funny though. Like, I mean, it's very, very rarely people have come up and, you know, have liked something that I've done and have told me, and it is amazing how much you will look down on. That person,
you don't want
to belong to a club that would have you as a member. No, I don't mean that, but like I understand the psychology of it, because you're immediately seeding ground and you are creating this dynamic in which of you, you know, has some kind of superiority, which is not the case at all.
Well, I have become friends with a couple of fans. You know, which is, there was a guy who in LA who loved Wilfred so much that he actually came to a social engagement wearing a dog suit.
Mm.
And once we got over that, I just like, get over it, mate. Ask me any question you want. Okay, we answered it. All right, great. After that, top guy, just the best, you know, and, you know, but I just think, you know, I think talking of Blue Heelers, Damien Walsh howling after he left Blue Heelers, you know, he needed to get a job because there's just, you know, as an actor in Australia, there's not much going. And so he became a lifeguard at the Richmond Pool. And so he did the course with a whole lot of other people, and everyone was like really starstruck and being weird to him on the first day. And afterwards he goes, "Okay, I'm just going to sit here, ask me any question you want, and I guarantee, you know, in 20 minutes you won't give a fuck anymore." And they did. And they didn't give a fuck anymore. He was right.
Yeah.
You know?
It's funny too, like, there are certain, like, I often hear comedians talk about, like, other comedians. Comedians are always the most unforgiving about other comedians. Like, you think but they always talk about, there are some kind of comedians who hate their fans. Like, they'll take their money, they'll willingly take their money, but they just fucking hate the audience that they've cultivated.
Wow.
And it's a really, like, cynical position to be in, where it's like, yeah, you know, I tell these jokes, but if you laugh at them, you're a fucking idiot.
Oh, my God.
But then I think there is the flip side of that with, like, people like Amanda Palmer or Kevin Smith, you know, these people who have small but really dedicated following. Like Kevin Smith's entire career now is catered to just that one audience. Like he has stopped trying to make things that appeal to large audiences. And he literally makes the most, I don't know what the word is, where, like, it's almost up its own ass. Like, he makes films about himself to feed to his fans who love him. And so I just saw the and I like Kevin Smith. I mean, I must admit, like, I like him more as a podcaster than I ever really did as a filmmaker. But now he's sort of drifted into this real kind of like circular kind of content creator. And I saw the trailer for Clerks 3 and I'm like, I'm watching it going, who is this? This is just for like a very, very small audience of the people. But rather than sort of go, good on him. Like he's just decided that he is going to, he knows who his audience is. He doesn't, has no interest in receiving criticism or, like he just wants to play the hits to a crowd that love the hits.
Mate, I think in many ways that's where entertainment's going.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, remember, you know, the idea of where we knew the top 10 films each week or top 10 singles, I mean, it's totally irrelevant. So you're just kind of playing to that audience and you hope to kind of slowly expand that audience. And then the byproducts are that you become immune to the lamp. Well, you're not part of the massive lambasting that goes on, you know. But by the way, does Kevin Smith do a podcast where he jumps in freezing water with his guests, like a kind of an ice bath?
I mean, he may. I haven't listened to them for a while, but I doubt it. That doesn't sound like something he would do.
So I used to see him in LA as well. You know, it became a thing. You know, if you go to Whole Foods on the corner of, Santa Monica and
it was near La Cienega, that one. Or La Brea.
No, the other side. It's a big one. I'm just wondering if I'm going to save. It's not Santa Monica. Is it West Hollywood? You can cut this out. This is really. If you don't cut it out, I'll just speak over.
I'm leaving this all in.
It's all.
Adam Googling.
It's your connection's not private. I can't look onto that one.
Does it matter where geographically it is? Is it essential to the story?
I don't know if it is essential to the story, but I used to see him there all the time. But I used to see all these kind of celebrities. You know, the guy who played Freddie Mercury. He was there. Odenkirk would always be there. And Kevin Smith would come in. And I used to always see Kevin Smith. And then he was kind of unhealthy looking and big. Then he had the heart attack. And he just lost, you know, three quarters of his body weight. Now. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, he's gone completely vegan. I think his philosophy is that he ate whatever he wanted for the first 45 years of his life, and now he's like, I'm going to be following a healthier diet.
He didn't really die.
Yeah. Well, I think it was called a widowmaker, the type of heart attack he had. It's because, like, there's a very rare
listeners
of people surviving that. And I believe that is the plot of Clerks 3, is that one of the clerks has a heart attack and then, you know, gets a new lease on life and decides to make a film about
what it's just, you know, fair what I mean? Facts. Like, if anyone cares. Oh, sorry. Sorry, there's a delay then.
That's all right.
You're talking about Widowmakers and I was talking about is the corner of Santa Monica and Fairfax.
No, I'm glad we came to that and came back to that. It was clearly bothering you.
Mate, I've been forgetting things recently, and I'm a little worried. So I think that's where it comes from. Why I needed to find out. I've been going, I forgot Mike Myers' name the other day.
But don't you think it's like the Homer Simpson rule, where Homer's like every time he learns something new, it pushes something old out. Like there's only
I hope so, mate.
bandwidth. And so it's like the longer you go on, you're absorbing, and there's a lot to take in with the world.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why I can't remember any of the names of the teachers from my high school. Mr. Hartley, my Latin
Mr.
teacher.
Hartley.
I think that's his name.
Mr. Hartley did dirty limericks in Latin. Fuck yeah.
Hic ud luscus in duperator. I believe that is, this is my, I'm going to actually have to look this up. Latin to English translator.
There was a podcast I used to listen to. It was Dax Shepherd, where there was fact checking at the end of it.
Right.
Where the assistant used to kind of trawl through the podcast and they go, okay, you got your Latin slightly wrong there. That in fact means blah, blah, blah. Now, Adam, you didn't go to school with the whole Wallabies. You only went to school with three of them.
They would actually do that at the end of the podcast.
Yeah.
I mean, if this is completely wrong, this is so baked into my memory. I was close. So I thought it was, hic ud luscus in duperator is, this is my one-eyed general. It's actually hoc est luscus generalis. So what does imperator mean? Luscus imperator. Well, I don't know if that's actually a word.
There's a huge ratings uptick around this point.
For the Latin heads out there. Imperator. Imperator means to is an emperor. Oh, so maybe it was, this is my one-eyed emperor. That's probably what it was.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, so instead of general, emperor.
Yeah, this is my one-eyed emperor. So I knew I'd remembered. I pretty much remembered that clearly.
Same person in power. Which one-eyed. Is lovely, a dick metaphor. So, yeah.
When it comes to dick metaphors, yeah. Let's not split dick metaphors.
You know, it's not going to make the Herald Sun that you got that wrong.
For you listeners out there, Adam was around for dinner the other night, and after you left, I was going to sleep, and I started thinking about your book, and a story that came up that I started laughing like as I was drifting off to sleep, annoying my wife, and I forgot to ask you about it because it's a story from 12 Summers, but. One of your early big breaks was that the ad campaign, the 3 for 3 campaign, right?
Yeah, yes.
Who was that for again? What company?
HBA, which was, I don't know, it's like basically Bupa these days. Yeah.
Bupa, right. Okay. So people might remember it, especially, you know, it was like late 90s, is that right?
It was in Victoria, South Australia and Northern Territory, I believe, or maybe West Australia. It was, it was 2001, and I was a guy. I had fake teeth made, and the conceit was I couldn't pronounce three. I would say free, and HBA were offering a deal 3 months for free. So I'd go and say, "Can I have three for free?" And yeah. It became a thing.
It was one of those things, like you know, back in the day, every now and then a commercial would just hit big, like like a Dougie the Pizza Boy. It would sort of become its own thing. But was that Bar took one? The Balinese.
Took my part. One leg went that way, and the other went like a crook.
Kid.
That was an HBA kid.
Yeah. So this was huge. I mean, but I didn't even realize until I read your book that was you. Like I didn't put two and two together. But I clearly remember that ad because we had the fake teeth in for a start. Tell people what the fallout from that was, because I was trying to tell Jem and her dad the next day about
the fallout. Did you show them the ad? That.
No, I didn't. I actually should show them the ad. I described it to them, but it was the fallout, because obviously Jem works in, you know, commercial direction.
Oh, yeah, because Tony Rogers directed that, and he also Bit Me in the Parts, that ad as well. You kind of have to be able to get those two references. But, yeah, So it was an ad. I was playing a character with, as stated, with buck teeth, and he was kind of gormless, but he was a really sweet character. Oh, yeah, can I have free for free? And she goes, what for free? And so, can I have free for free? She went, oh, free, three for three, free for free. And I go, yeah, that's it. And I say, does that also include optical? And she says, yes, and dental. And that's, anyway, you kind of go out on that, right?
Yeah.
And did the ad, And then it wasn't screening in Queensland. I went for a holiday in Queensland and I came back. And suddenly I was famous in Victoria. like really famous. Like not the fame, not cool fame. Not like, oh, wow, there's David Beckham. It was really uncool fame.
Not Peter Phelps at the bar with two blondes. And
no, that's right. It was like people just like, putting their arms over me. Hey, say it, say it. And I have to say, can I have free for free? Oh, you're better in the ad. No, I had the teeth in the ad. Anyway, people running after me as I was walking. Like I'd go for a jog and people would chase me while I was jogging. Wow. And get photos with me, or the major thing was to put me on the phone to their wives. They'd literally run me, chase me down, grab hold of me, ring their wives. I've got him, the free guy. I've got him. He's here. Say hi. And I have to say fucking hi. And then there was the
which
situation,
which is stunning because it's more a visual gag than it is an oral gag.
Oh, it was always disappointing. When they caught me, it was disappointing for them. It was disappointing for their wives. It was disappointing, obviously, for me. But, you know, I was in the phone book, Charlie. So people knew it was Adam Zwar. The word got out that it was Adam Zwar. And so they looked me up where I lived. And it didn't say I lived at flat 7, number 7, West Bank Terrace. It just said number 7, West Bank Terrace. But the woman who was the who managed the apartments, happily told everyone where I fucking lived, what my apartment was. So I get door knocked, and also I got cupcakes and stuff left for me and notes saying, I just want to be kind to you and all that kind of shit, and which was sweet. And, you know, so – and then there was in the book, which I talk about, was the kid who had to leave school because he was called free for free. He was being bullied all the time.
Yeah.
And I had to go, the advertising agency made me go around and speak to this kid. And it just made the whole situation worse because it's clear that I don't have buck teeth. I was wearing fake teeth.
So let's not like burn the steps on this. Cause this is what I want to work through is, so the agency, they get a bit of blowback and some bad press around a bullied kid at school.
Yeah, at school he had his parents dragged him out. The ad has made,
and the ad made his life hell because everyone's calling him free for free. And so the agency, in a desperate scramble to kind of like change the narrative or you know get some good publicity, are like, well, we'll get the actor from the ad to go meet the kid, do a meet and greet. And somehow,
but they told me to bring my teeth.
Things over, so that's their.
But they told me to bring the
like
fake
that's going to make it better.
So they're in my pocket, and they briefed me. And I said, I don't think I should bring out the teeth because they're fake, and he's got real teeth. No, they're going to love it. He's going to love it. And I went, oh really? And you know where there's, you know, so I've been told a pup, you know. All the way out to – we went all the way out past Williamstown. Maybe it was Coburg. Altona. And so we went out there, and it was almost like one of those – it was a whole lot of kids in this very rundown house. One of the rooms had a dirt floor, and there was also a lot of animals in the house, like dogs, cats, chickens in the house.
Yeah.
Big sit down, introduced to the kid, and they're just trying, and they say something at him. All the ad agency people look $1 million. They look like they're on a very good wicket. I look like me. I look like just, you know, normal out of work actor. And they were, so there's a kind of a massive wealth chasm there between the ad agency people and the people in the house. All the ad agency people
and
all
so
had perfect
the
teeth.
Had the ad agency organized like cameras? Were they trying to document this for some good press? Like, were they trying to leverage out of it?
I think the school had complained to the press. And so this was us just placating them. There were no, I don't remember if there was, I don't think there was anyone there from the local paper. because that came later.
Yeah.
And so I'm talking to the guy and I said, you know, I used to have buck teeth too. You know, it's like, it's hard. And then I remembered that my parents could afford braces. And then I looked over at his mum and his mum just shook her head. Like, we're not buying braces. And I went, I kind of grew out of it. Like, I remember stopping him mid-stream.
My teeth.
And he just looked at me as if to say, that's not going to happen, mate. And then the ad agency women are kind of like pointing at my pocket where my teeth were. Show him the teeth. And I went, oh, he's not going to look at the teeth. And I said, do you want to have a look at the teeth, mate? And he goes, no. And so the whole thing was a disaster. And then they were kind of blaming me on the way back, saying I should have been more upbeat. And I said, what's there to be upbeat about? The kid's miserable. I totally get it. There's nothing I can say that's going to take away the fact that he's got buck teeth and he's being bullied at school because of me. And in the end, the ad agency just stumped up $2,000 and got his teeth fixed, got him braces, which they should have done in the first place.
I mean, that's the best part of the story. Were you getting paid for your time?
No.
Like, you'd signed on to do this ad.
Yeah.
That was it. And so this extracurricular to save the ad agency some bad press, there was no reimbursement. There was nothing. They just
disdain
for your lack of effort.
You've done ads, haven't you?
Yeah, but you don't. You could have said no.
You get paid for the ad, and then they say the ad's going to run in these territories, and if you there's more loading if you get on if it's more than just like Victoria, and if it goes around Australia, you get more loading on top of that, and then there's a photo shoot generally, and you get a little bit of extra money for the photo shoot. And that's it. That's your day done. Nowhere in the contract does it say you're going to be picked up and taken to Altona to speak to some kid who's been bullied because of your ad. No, I mean, I would have charged a lot of extra money so much extra money if I thought of that. I mean, it was a really traumatic experience. And I don't know why I was.
It's just awful.
And it was like that whole notion of being a team player, which is bullshit too. It's like, be a team player. What team? I don't want to be part of your team.
Yeah.
But I was very susceptible to that kind of shit in those days. Like, if anyone said, "I'll be a team player," Adam, that would get me. I go, "Oh, okay." You know?
Yeah.
Are you saying I'm not a nice bloke?
You don't want to be a prick. And there probably would have been an element as well where you're like, "Oh shit, I don't want this kid to suffer because of me." Like, you are a compassionate person.
Yeah, yeah, of course. Think, yeah.
Well, maybe it would help. But I just the thing that like was making me laugh was just like how poorly thought out the strategy was. Like,
yeah.
there was no strategy really.
It was just
like if you just sort of war gamed it, like, okay, so this is what will happen. We'll take the actor out and just extrapolate it on what the likely outcome of that encounter would be. At no point in my mind would I have gone, oh, the kid will start laughing, the parents will hug, they'll go back to school and he'll be made school captain and all the kids who bullied him.
What a horrible tactical kind of misstep the whole thing was. Yeah. And like, maybe they thought, maybe it tapped into the fact that at that point I was kind of a little bit famous in Melbourne, it must be said, nowhere else. And they thought that quote unquote celebrity thing would actually, you know, push the situation over the line, which it didn't. He wasn't interested. I was the name. I was the face for his pain, and it was all horrible. And I got blamed for it. Good afternoon.
Yeah,
it was a good afternoon. Well spent. I really debated whether to put that in the book.
I've done a lot of those Good Friday appeals, hospital visits, and stuff, which are actually fantastic, and I think they're great. Like, they are a great way of breaking up a day for not only the kids but the families who have to spend, weeks sometimes in these hospitals. But I was, after the first couple of years of doing it, I got very good at picking up when a kid had no interest or if they were just waiting to see an AFL player or something like that. And I was very good at extracting it because initially I would go in because, like you, I'm like, I want to do the right thing. And I would sit with a kid and a lot of the times parents who had zero idea of who I was and zero interest in me being there. And if anything, I was just making the situation worse. I would see other actors, you know, from various shows I've worked on, really pushing hard, like virtually like juggling and doing handstands, thinking that they needed to get a reaction and, you know, to do their job, entertain this kid. But sometimes you just got to go, oh, no, like this is not, you want to meet Nick Natanui, that's fine. I'll just duck out and I'll see if I can grab Nick Natanui for you. That's
fine.
I can read the situation.
Well, me too. It is because it's a, you know, it's a situation we're all familiar with in Australia. It's like, oh, you're an actor, are you? Or you do TV. Oh, yeah, what shows are you on? And you list the shows. Nah, haven't heard of them. And you go, well, that's fine. But what, you know, I don't tell people now. I just go, look, you probably haven't heard of them. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. My bugbear used to be that I would get someone to come up and say, hey, I've never heard of you, but my sister's a big fan and would like a photograph. And I was always like, you could have made the same request without the disclaimer at the start.
My brother's a big fan.
I don't know who you are. That's fine. I don't know who you are. We don't need that. We don't need that exchange. Like, I'm happy to help you out, but just for some reason, like, you just need to let me know that you don't think what I do matters.
Well, that's right. Or the caveat being that, you know, or the caveat of like, my sister's a fan, as in they could even say that, you know, it's like, I've viewed the length and breadth of your work and it has, as far as I'm concerned, it has come up short. But my sister, for some bizarre reason, loves it.
I would respect that. If someone had come up and actually said, look, I have seen everything you've done, frankly, not impressed. For some reason, though, my sister would like a photo.
Yeah. It doesn't resonate with me. And I've had debates with my sister about this, but no, you know, she won't be swayed. So I'm going to need your photo and an autograph. Yeah, that's happened a lot.
I've been on the other side of that equation where actually I've got the jumper right here. When Rob Harvey, this is an actual what I'm holding up for Adam. This is actually Rob Harvey's jumper. I won this in a raffle when I was 12.
Wow!
A raffle at Moorabbin. And when Rob Harvey played his 350th game, they did a big testimonial dinner at Marvel Stadium. It was Telstra Dome back then, and I took my brother. You know, $300 tickets or something like that to have this dinner. And then afterwards, you know, Rob gave his speech and then was sort of mingling and you could sort of just go up and have a chat to him. And my brother was really, really nervous. My brother's very shy and he was really nervous. So I had to go up and say, hey, Rob, you know, my brother would really like a photograph. Is that cool? And Rob was very obliging. I didn't say, hey, Rob, my brother's a big fan. I think that you should have won 3 Brownlows.
That's right.
And so he got the photo. So my brother got the photo and then I said to Rob, I said, look, you know, really admire you. I'm a huge Saints fan. Just, you know, thank you so much for what you've done for the club. And I said, funny story, Rob. When I was 12 years old, we beat the Hawks at Moorabbin for the first time in like 17 years. And I was at that game. And afterwards I went to the social club and there was a raffle and I won your jumper. And Harves is like, oh, that's great. Excellent. And then I said to him, I've still got it, Rob. And I saw the look on his face shift between, oh, that's a nice story, to, no. I'm like, oh, no. Like, I mean, Rob Harvey had a sidestep like no other. And he did a great shimmy to just merge back into the crowd.
That's right. It kills you. But you know what? No one was there to kind of remind you of that. It's like, unfortunately, Amanda was there when I met Alan Border. And I said to Alan Border, oh, you still live in Chapel Hill? And he goes, yeah. And I named the street and then I named the number. And, you know, you can tell the, ha! And the thing is, I used to take Border's weekends in the house next door. So the family that I stayed at Border's weekends with was next door to Alan Border. That's how I knew. But just the watching the blood drain from his face and then and Amanda pointing out that I got too far. The whole thing, it just like, I hadn't seen the conversation from his perspective at all. I just sent it from mine, and once I realized,
well, you're on a roll because you, you're on a roll. You'd sort of got him, and so it's hard because you're like, oh, this person that I admire, we're connecting, and so you start bringing out more and more info, and then you share too much.
Oh, and also, I think I was just overexcited because he'd seen a play that I'd written. It was called The Inner Sanctum, and it was about cricket. And he'd seen the play, and he thought the actors had written it themselves because people not in the industry tend to think that sometimes. And so that he went up to the actors and he said, how did you get all that right, all that cricket stuff? That's exactly what the dressing room talks like and blah, blah, blah. They said, well, we didn't do it. It was Adam. Adam wrote it. He came over and he goes, oh, mate, that was great. I really loved it. So I was on a high. And then, because, you know, he was my hero. And then I said a bunch of stupid shit. What can you do?
You should never
meet your heroes. What are you
going to do? you should never meet your heroes in case you scare them into thinking that you're some kind of stalker.
And by the way, sports people too. You know, it's like, forget about it. It's like Robert Harvey, Alan Border. You know, if I met Juddy, that'd be weird. I just wouldn't be able to behave like a normal human. So I can meet any actor. Doesn't matter, director, singer, none of that matters. But sports people, it's like it ticks onto another part of my brain and I act stupid.
Well, if you want to know some more fantastic stories, Adam's got a book full of them, 12 Summers, available now. I'll put a link in the episode description. Adam, thanks so much for coming back on FOFOP.
Thanks, Charlie.
Hilarious that you were literally in my house 2 days ago with all the recording equipment, but we waited 2 days later to do it like down the line. I only live 20 minutes away. That's the world we live in now.
The world we live in. And by the way, can I just say that last time I was on your show, it was a huge uptick in 12 Summers sales. So you've got sway.
All right.
And I really appreciate
that. Make
it
happen again.
Thanks. Thank you. And thank you, listeners.
Well, you're welcome. You're welcome back on the show anytime to talk about 12 Summers or stalking athlete you like. That's an invitation. That's FOFOP for this week. I'm Charlie Clawson.
Oh, I'm Adam Zwa.
You say you're Adam Zwa.
I'm Adam Zwa.